Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow it just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the TBI Network.
Find them on facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbifn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in Middle America. Hope you guys are all having a good week. We're not quite to spring yet, even though we're officially there, but at least unlike last Wednesday night, it isn't snowing. So that's good news. And the birds are singing. So there should be some green pushing through the ground pretty soon. And I can't wait to see the color and the new life emerging and the happy things that come to me in spring, because I have seasonal affective disorder. So I look forward to dropping that load. Some of you, and I will repost it, but last Wednesday was the last of my series of first eye surgery and then weekly treatments that my couple-month project, and the only reason I'm mentioning it is because I had posted a flyer about a speaking engagement, and you know that I love radio. 30 years ago, I would have loved the visual aspect of streaming live, not so much now. But I did tell a group, some of you know I'm writing a new book and it's on the evolution of mental health. And I was asked to be a speaker last Thursday night, and the poster was posted, for lack of a better word for a moment, in a number of different places that had the date for last Wednesday. Well, a couple complications after my very last eye adjustment last Wednesday, and I could only get my eyes half open, and it felt like I had hot coals as eyeballs, and my eyes were just crying. Not literally crying, they were watering and wouldn't stop watering. And so that would not be the night to debut visually. And so I did get a hold of the folks in Missouri, and that is rescheduled for April 13th. I haven't gotten a new poster, but I did hurry and have Gary last Thursday, right underneath, has been rescheduled due to a minor health issue, which I didn't know if that's what it was. It did turn into being that, but the event is rescheduled for Thursday, April 13th, same time, same link, and I will repost as we get closer. So I'm glad to say that I'm better this week and finished and am the product of some newer technology, and I can see close up and far away without glasses for the rest of my life, and don't have cataracts anymore. So I'm really glad for that. The bump in the road, I guess we've all experienced that, right? So for those of you who are new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. this is a we recovery program because it is in the we that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers, and for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. Again, I'm your regular Wednesday host, Kim Justice, and if you want to know more about me, you can check out my website, inaflash.org. And tonight, when I play the generic intro, it's when I have one of my special co-hosts, and tonight is Simon Says, and this is the last Wednesday of each month special show where my friend and our common survivor, Simon Lewis, is co-host. And if you want to know more about Simon, you can check out his website, riseandshinethebook.com. And that intro, I do like to give him a plug, is our founder when his band was the THEE, the letter R, Insane, the R, Insane. But actually, apologies, that song is older when his band, same people, but they were called something else. It's a song called Words. A portion of the song called Words. And I just like to let them know the band is no longer together, but in the middle of COVID, they did their final five, I'll call it an album because I'm old, five album session set, going to be the end of their performing together, and they were just getting ready to go on tour. They had just gotten the five sets of music finished, just getting ready to go on tour, and COVID happened, and the tour did not. And so I'm not sure if the website is still up or not, but if it is, therinsane.com, you'll find some great music, and this is the time to get it before he decides to pull the site down at some point, and that music won't be heard anywhere but here, which has happened before with other artists. I was looking the other day at my own artists, and you know, I go back 12 and a half years or so doing this and probably have 50 independent artists, and six of them are no longer with us. And I thought about it, you know, so they don't have websites anymore. They were indies, so nobody is owning or promoting their music anymore. They're not touring. And I felt very sad about the fact they're no longer here, very blessed that this is one of the last places people all over the world will hear their music and their name and their mark, one of the many marks, I'm sure, that they made while they were here. And I think that's a good thing, because not only are our shows live, but they're on demand, and so people like Alan Kitto and Garfan and a number of the others I have on the board are still heard. And as Daniel Christian would say, they're still finding their voice long past their presence here. Now, I thought Michael was going to be coming on for a moment. I'm not sure if I made my introduction too long or if something else came up. We'll see if he calls back. But in the meantime, I'm going to bring on my appreciated co-host, Simon Lewis. Simon, welcome to the end of the month in April pretty quick.
Unbelievable, Kim, isn't it? Unbelievable. We're nearly through the first quarter of this year. It's lovely to be on the show again, and I just want to say a couple of things in response to what you're saying. Seasonal affective disorder, I would never have believed it before my head injury. And now in California, California has four seasons, spring, summer, fire, and flood. And we are now in the flood season, big time. So, and it's cold. I agree with you. And I know it's not cold by the standards of the Midwest. It's not cold by the standards of Canada. But by the standards of an Englishman who came to California many years ago in search of the Golden State and the sunshine, 55 degrees feels absolutely freezing. So I can't wait for the sun to come out a bit longer and the ground to heat up and for your co-hosts on the last Wednesday of each month to go outside and bake, because that's the right thing to do. I'm sorry to hear about your eyes. I wasn't quite clear, though. Are you saying that you're through the hot coals stage, or are you saying that that hot coals experience was abnormal? How's it resolved? And by the way, and good luck on your psychology presentation on the 13th. And the last thing I want to say before I come back to your hot coals point, the music you play, because I have this little list, and so I wanted to say everything, get it all out there. The song you play, the song Words, and I was thinking as we're wrapping up Brain Injury Awareness Month, in a way, isn't awareness of the mind all about words? What a great song that is. Our ability to remember our words, our ability to form words, to learn new words, to make words, to communicate with them. I think it's a beautiful song, and I think that your musician and founder of co-founder of Brain Injury Radio Network is very talented. But now I want to come back to the eyes and the hot coals, because I think the fact that you've eliminated cataracts, can see sharp, close up, and distance, all sounds extraordinary and full of hope, because that's what we're talking about really on the show. With COVID, with all the challenges, we'll talk about there's always what I call in my book Reason for Hope and Hope for Reason. Can you just go into a little bit about the stage with the eye, your eyes feeling like hot coals, because that sounds pretty catastrophic. Then what was the resolution?
It
was it normal
like
or abnormal?
Well, they said it was normal. It was abnormal to me, you know. It was the last, the way that it happened is you, back on January 24th, I had the surgery to remove the cataracts and put in the new lenses. Just in the FYI category for anybody out there who is ever having cataract surgery is exactly the same process. The only thing that's different is what type of new lenses you choose to have put in your eyes. Now, the kind that Medicare pays for most of is one that your vision would just be as it is, and they would put just new clean lenses in. And just to explain to people that don't know, what it's like when you get cataracts is like looking out a dirty window. So, you know, the light isn't getting all the way through your eyes to be able to see things as well as you usually do. It's like looking out a dirty window in your house or out your back door. You know, it just, things aren't as clear. And as it progresses, and mine didn't progress to this point, some people wait until that happens, but they can barely see at all. They're like looking through a pinhole of what they can see left, and everything else is so dirty, like a real, real, real dirty window. So that's a simplistic view of what, description of what cataracts are. So the surgery, same for everybody, back on the 24th. The lenses I chose were not the Medicare lenses, because I haven't worn glasses. You know, when I was 12 is when my vision was shot, and the only thing they made back then, the states, me, that's okay, is hard contacts. And at 12 years old, being a girl, never having worn glasses, I smacked those hard contacts in and wore those puppies like no problem. And I wore them until I was about 43. And then somewhere right when I met Gary, I made the decision to have LASIK surgery. And it was where one eye was 20/20, and one eye they undercorrect just a little bit so that you can see close up and far away. And so for the last about 20 years, my vision was like that. But one thing that happens as you age in your reading eye, a lot of you that wear readers now know what I'm talking about, is, you know, you used to be able to see close up and far away, and then all of a sudden your reading eye starts getting a little weaker and you get reading glasses and use them. The last 2 years or so, I've been using readers for my computer. And if I read small print, but that's a whole nother thing. I used to be a voracious reader, and I can do that on articles now, but I really can't sit down and read a thick book the way that I could prior to my brain injury. But in any case, when it came to knowing I was having this surgery and having a consultation with the doctor, one of the options is something called a light adjustable lens, LAL. And that's just what it implies, that the lens is adjustable by light, UV light to be exact. And so what happened was January 24th, I had my cataract surgery and they put in the new lenses. Then they waited. There's a ton of videos on YouTube you can look up about this. Some of them, make sure to look at how old they are. If they're a couple years old or 5 years old, you want to find something more recent. And some doctors vary it a little bit on the timing. My doctor, I'm glad, was more cautious. Instead of waiting 2 weeks like some doctors, it was a month to allow my eyes to heal from the eye surgery, the cataract surgery. And then at that point, they start adjusting those adjustable new lenses in your eye by you looking into a machine and them shining a beam of UV light into your eyes one at a time for about 45 seconds each. And people might have to do that anywhere from 2 to 5 times depending on their happiness level and their doctor's happiness level if their vision is where they want it to be. And when you get to, for me, that was 3 times to get my vision where I needed it to be able to see close up and far away clearly. I've got an eagle eye in my right eye, 20/20, and my left eye is the one that allows me to read and see far away. So anyway, after the 3 adjustments, one thing I did not know, I knew they did at the end what they call a lock-in procedure. And the lock-in procedure simply does just that. When your eyes have gotten adjusted to the point where your vision is perfect, you know, or where you want it to be, they do something that is like an adjustment, with that same machine in the same light, but they lock in that vision that they've created so that when you go out in the sun, and I forgot to mention, from the time I got those lenses in for 2 months, then I had to wear these glasses. They give you two pair, a pair of sunglasses and a pair of clear ones, and you have to wear them. And this was most obnoxious to me because I wasn't used to wearing glasses ever, all the time, you know, from the moment I got up till the moment I got to bed. But what they were was a pair of sunglasses and a pair of clear glasses that blocked out any UV light, because otherwise, heaven forbid, that even through the window in your house, that any UV light would touch your eye, then they would start self-adjusting without being under, you know, the sun wouldn't be under the advice of the doctor, and you could ruin everything you just did, you know. So you really got to protect your eyes from natural UV light during the time these adjustments are being done and until you get the lock-in done, where then going out into the sun with your new eyeballs, they're not going to shift or change from all that time you invested in getting the adjustments. Well, I didn't know a couple things. I didn't know there were two adjustments, and they had told me in the past that I might see a little pink tinge on things, or that my eyes might be a little blurry for the day of. And, you know, your eyes are dilated the size of a frickin' saucer for all of this, every single treatment. Another thing that really bothered me, because I don't do well with my eyes dilated. I don't feel safe when I can't see clearly walking and things like that. Didn't bother me when I drank many years, 36 years ago, but excuse me, after my brain injury, it does bother me, scares me, you know, about tripping or falling or whatever. So anyway, I found out you had to have two lock-in procedures, and I did okay, and I never saw a pink tinge before on anything. And then the last day that I went was last Wednesday, and I was so excited that day because it was a long road, and the road before that, as you know, all of December was hard. All of January was hard, and so then I embarked on this two-month thing that I really felt I had bit off more than I could chew more than once, and I was afraid to cry. I didn't want to mess up my eyes or do anything that would mess up my eyes. It was just that part of it was not good, all of it, because I was just upset, you know, about the dilated eyes, the going there every week, you know, getting these treatments. I guess I had just been a little mindless. See, I had rescheduled three times. It was originally scheduled for just after Thanksgiving, and I called and I said, you know, my parents are both older and have some health issues, and it's the holiday season, and I'm a photographer. I would really like to take this holiday season to not have my eyes messed up, to be able to take great holiday pictures for my family. So I need to reschedule. I hadn't thought of that before, but now I've got an overwhelming need to do that. So we rescheduled for January 6th. Well, in the time in between, I never did. I had to call him January 6th and say, well, I never got the holiday pictures. My dad got sick and passed away. And so December was gone. He was in the hospital part of that, hospice part of that, and then he passed away Christmas morning, so I did not get the pictures, but I'm not going to be able to do this surgery on the 6th of January because I've got to settle the estate. My mom and dad have been together since they were 15. She's hamstrung, you know. She's not able to do this stuff right now, so I'm going to need to get him buried, settle the estate, et cetera, et cetera. So we rescheduled for February 24th. So to February 24th was the first adjustment. Then the next Friday was the second adjustment. Then the next Friday was the third adjustment. Then the next Friday was the first lock-in. Then last Wednesday, that one got to be a little shorter. They were always on Friday. Until last Wednesday, the last lock-in, and I was ready to party and send up fireworks that finally that was going to be over. And my eyes, I had been seeing great, crystal clear, perfect. And so I went in for that last treatment, and he wanted to warn me that the light was about 5 times brighter than it normally is for the last lock-in. And when you look into the machine with one eye, there's a little blue dot way down yonder that you're supposed to be focusing on the blue dot. And then when he says, okay, we're going to start, then all of a sudden, 5 or 6 lights, bright lights, like if somebody took the brightest flashlight on the planet, 6 of them in a circle, up closer to your eye, and you hear tick, 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 and that's where he's adjusting. These lenses are made of silicone polymers. So whatever polymers are left at the end when they do the lock-in that haven't been pulled into your visual field to adjust your vision, they get rid of. I also had astigmatism. That was the reason, by the way, for me selecting what I selected, because if you've had prior eye surgery, so if you had like RK back in the day or LASIK, then you can't get monovision or any of the other choices. Your only two choices are the Medicare way, where you are pretty much committing to wearing glasses the rest of your life, which is not a problem for some people. I just have not been used to that. And so my only other option was the light adjustable lens. So that was why I picked it. And so that last day, it was so bright. You know, I'm focusing on the blue dot, but those lights that are already too bright and make you want to pull your head back, but you know not to move. And in fact, when your chin is in, you know, one of those machines where your chin's in there and your forehead is against a strap, they even have the nurse not holding hard, but holding the back of your head, knowing that you're going to have a tendency to want to pull back and run. It was so bright that time. I never had trouble except discomfort with dealing with it, but everything was okay. This time they were so bright. They put numbing drops in along with the other one, so things were okay when I left, except, you know, my eyes are still dilated, and this time I saw a pink tinge on everything. It was really weird. Talk about life through rose-colored glasses. I had rose-colored eyeballs, and it was pretty trippy. You know, that one dog, Eddie, our puppy, is light fawn color, and he looked pink. everything had a tinge of pink. But then a couple hours later, the numbing drops started wearing off, and my eyeballs felt so burnt hot, like they were hot coals in my eye sockets. And they burnt
wow.
so badly that I closed my eyes and water, you know, tears were just coming out my eyes. And I could get my eyes halfway open, but they were just tearing so bad and they hurt so bad. I got a cool washcloth and I laid on the bed and I put the cool washcloth over my eyes and I asked Gary if he would call the doctor. And he said, well, what am I supposed to do? I said, all right, well, what you're supposed to do. I don't get tense very often, but this was one of those, okay? I said, what I want you to do is look up their goddamn number and give me the phone. And I'm laying on the bed with this rag over my eyes, right? But nobody can describe it like I can right at that minute. You know, if you don't know how to put it in words, let me help. Just get me the number and the phone. And so he handed me my phone, and I called, and I told him what was going on. I said, what in the hell? And the nurse came back after talking to the doctor and said that it was normal. And I said, well, it doesn't feel like it's normal. You know, I haven't had this feeling ever in all the times I've been there. I was ready to have a party and celebrate. You know, this is sheer hell. And this is what I'm doing. And she said, well, you might, a couple things, you're doing the right thing, you know, is get some rest and alternate warm rag, cool rag, and really saturate your eyes in lubricant drops, you know, maybe 8 times during the day. And it'll probably be like that tomorrow, too. And then you're going to find it will resolve. And if it doesn't, call us. And that's what I was left with. But that's pretty much how it happened. I won't, that worst that I described to you went on for that day and did go on for the next day. And it was really freaking miserable and scary. The next day, my eyes quit watering, and I could open them, but I wore the sunglasses around the house all day because the light sensitivity was, well, like someone with a new brain injury. Everything was too bright, even in my house with the curtains closed. We have kind of sheer curtains, but it was just too bright. So day three, I wore my sunglasses, and day four I could take them off and things felt pretty normal, but my eyeballs still kind of felt tender and I was still putting in drops because that really dried my eyes out, I'll tell you that. And then by the next day I could see everything again, but I was naive, not thinking, didn't know, but, you know, the next night I was supposed to be streaming live on Facebook and YouTube doing this talk about the book that I'm writing, which I haven't picked up since October. I've written and got edited the contents, preface, and the first 5 chapters, and then the material to write the rest of the book. But I've lived a lifetime since I picked that book up last time. So when the lady sent me the note, not knowing anything about any of this, reminding me of my engagement that next night, I didn't immediately cancel her because I thought back on the other times, like with the adjustments and that, you know, the next day, it took pretty much a lot of the next day to get my eyes undilated. But once they were undilated, they were just a little blurry, and I wasn't going to need notes. It's an hour talk, and I'm used to doing, you know, ask me what time it is, I tell you how the watch works. So I really thought it was also another one of those kinds of thinking that you'd be able to do it or handle it, you know. And the truth of the matter is I couldn't. It was too much. And then when what happened, I had to write her and say, there's just no way I can do this. I wouldn't be able to put makeup on my face. My eyes are crying. I can't open my eyeballs. There's just no way. And I am so, so sorry to be letting you know the day of. I'm a host. I hate people that do what I'm doing to you. But I'm just sorry. I didn't know it was going to be like this. And she was super gracious, super nice. People wish me well. And what the heck is that?
Oh, Kim, I apologize. I thought that my headset microphone would be very directional. And so what I'm doing here is I'm lowering blinds. But I apologize. It'll last a few more seconds, and it'll never happen again. Because what it demonstrates is that the studio microphone headset I use isn't that directional. So it's about to finish. I apologize, and I say I won't do that again. I've never done it before, but I thought, I know. There, I stop now. So that's. But let me come back to you. When did the redness? What happened to the redness in your eyesight? This is so interesting.
The pinkness.
Yes.
The pinkness and the burning went away. It was the same the next day. I went kind of late in the day, which was also unusual. I went every Friday, and I went in the morning, but that particular time, it was Wednesday, and it was in the afternoon, and so it was probably dinner time for us when all hell broke loose the day of the doctor on that Wednesday. Well, Thursday, everything was the same, and I was doing the same thing, so I had to call the lady. Well, I actually had to have Gary type her an email. She wasn't in the office, and her assistant said I needed to send the gal an email. And I said, well, I'm supposed to be the speaker tonight. Can you make sure she gets the email if you don't want to give me her number at home? And she said that she would call and do it. Well, I couldn't see to do an email. So I said, Gary, can you take dictation? I need to cancel on this lady, but I can't see to type it. And so he did, and like I said, she was super gracious, understanding, couldn't have been nicer about it, and we did reschedule for April 13th. So as far as the pink tinge and all that, it was the 2 days, the day of the doctor, the rest of that day, all of the next day, and then that was gone. And I could open my eyes again, and it wasn't pink anymore, and they weren't tearing anymore. But the next day was the day I had to wear sunglasses from the time I got up till the time I went to bed in the house, because everything was just so bright. It was like we had 100 million watt bulbs on everywhere in the house, and our house was pretty dark inside. It's not Finn Choi.
So if I make him,
but anyway,
is that partly, you talked earlier about how the effect of looking through a dirty window, how has that changed? How's the clarity, the brightness, has that maintained now as you move away from those side effects? Are you now seeing as if you're looking through crystal?
Yeah, everything is more accurate and tight in its color and its form, both far away and close up.
Oh, that's so exciting, it did what it was supposed to. Especially as a photographer.
Well, it is, because one thing, and I would have sued the guy. I can't explain this, why I didn't sue the guy. But back when I got that LASIK 20 years ago, I had told the doctor, and he was the go-to surgeon in town for corrective eye surgery. And it made you, this is kind of funny, it made you feel comfortable, maybe some of you uncomfortable, but think about somebody who's going to be working on your eyes with a laser. When you went into his office, it was filled with trophies of men holding a gun. He was some kind of a trap shooter, marksman, something, and he had that many trophies for competitive marksmanship. So you thought, well, hell, he ought to be able to fire a laser if he's so good at firing guns. And he was, but the big but was I had told him I was a photographer, so I needed my right eye dominant and my left eye to be my reader. Well, I knew I was younger and both eyes were really good at that point. And so I could still see, you know, to take pictures. But the truth of the matter is, and this guy bought his practice when he retired, so this is the other way to confirm what I know. He had my old records. That guy, that hotshot, screwed up. He made my left eye dominant. So what's happened the last 3 years is I've had to wear readers, like I was saying, is that taking pictures, you've seen me take a lot of pictures, but the difference is prior to wearing the readers, I could do it in one shot. And what I've been doing, talk about compensatory strategies that tell on myself, the last 3 years I've needed readers and that eye hasn't been as crisp. Like looking at Hootie, I couldn't see him crisply the times I was taking pictures unless I was up on the ladder. But what I would do is just thank God for digital. Click, 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 click. You know, I was taking 10, 12 pictures of everything to find the one that was in focus. And so another thing that this surgery did, I mean, it was what it was. I didn't do anything about this doctor back then because it didn't really wind up being a problem. And I was thrilled at that time, I remember, because I didn't have to wear contacts anymore. You know, I didn't have to bother with contacts. And my eyeballs were just that great. And so I guess for whatever reason, if I realized it early on, and I don't really think I did realize it early on. I don't think I realized it till a little later and just didn't pursue it because I probably figured it was too late, and it was. But this guy, when he did my eyeballs, was able to do it the way the last guy was supposed to. My right eye is dominant now, and so my picture taking, when I get back to it, hopefully I'll get outside soon. It's been cold here, and some other things have been going on, and I haven't even been out of the house since last Wednesday. So I hope next week it's going to be a little warmer, and I'll look forward to taking the camera and going out into the country and taking some picture with my new right eye where everything will be crisp and colorful and being able to get the shot on the first one again. So it was great that he could correct that and make the right eye dominant if I wanted to keep taking pictures. And then did good by the left eye. Now, I think, and this may not happen because, you know, it's going to take, I mean, I'm done. It's done, and my vision is really good. But
fantastic.
It was very tiring to go through all of it. it's been tiring to go through everything. And so one thing I'm noticing is that at night, which I never do, but if I wanted to go into my computer right now and I'm at the time where my eyes are weary and it's dim, then I might, I bought a pair of the lightest kind of reader, one pair, because I thought, you know, if it was dim and I was eye weary, I might need that just to help me, you know. Nothing I would carry, nothing I would need all the time, but my eyes are tired. They're really tired right now from the ordeal that they've been through, and physically and probably psychologically from everything that's been going on. But he also said that, you know, all of this made swelling and likely inflammation. And he said that, and I believe him because it was like this before we did the lock-in stuff. I wouldn't have even dreamed of getting a light reader. I could see everything. And right now I'm looking at the studio and logged in tonight and the chat room's in front of me and the switchboard and everything, and I don't have any glasses or need them to see it. So
fantastic.
Yeah, long way around the story. Sorry about that, folks, but now you at least know a little something about cataracts and the options. Now, what my mom had done, just I'll make it really quick, she did not have prior surgery. So just to finish the story for anybody out there who's looking at cataract surgery sometime, is another one of the options is called monovision. And that's where they do exactly much shorter. I had the longest, most involved procedure, okay? So for anybody who just gets, if you feel horrified after what I just told you, please know that if you get the Medicare paid for surgery, all it is that one day of surgery. That's it. And then you heal and you see the way you're going to see. And if you need to get a pair of glasses, you get a pair of glasses. That's the end of it. You don't go through anything that I just described. Monovision does the same thing for people who have not had a prior eye surgery and who don't have a significant astigmatism. And that's where basically with the lenses, they do what that LASIK doctor did for me. And that's they give you a 20/20 lens in one of your eyes, and they just undercorrect a little on your other eye, and you're able to see close up and far away. But that's also done in one surgery, which is not to say, you know, you don't go back and get a check, you know, get checked. The next day, you go back just to get your eye pressure checked. You go back 2 weeks later to make sure you're healing right. But then that's the end for everyone else. So,
if I may, Pim, to clarify one thing, because I find this so interesting, I think a lot of listeners will also, because you've often said about one eye being dominant and the other eye being undercorrected. With the adjustable light adjustable system that you're describing, as you are at present, is it that if you cover one eye that you can see close up and distant, and then if you cover the other eye, you can also see close up and distant? Or is it that one of the eyes is less good at that?
The latter of what you just said, my right eye, which is 20/20 seeing far away, if I cover my left eye right now, then that studio I told you I could see really well. I still can, but it's blurry because my left eye is the one.
You're covered, but the brain compensates.
Yes, and one thing that I'll tell you also, and everybody's different, so I'm not a doctor, I can't guarantee you anything. But what I can tell you is when I did it with contacts, when I did it with LASIK surgery, and when I did it with this surgery, my brain did not know the difference. It was instant compensation. It didn't, in fact, what I can tell you is I tried to get bifocals once, and those things made me want to throw up. And I had that feeling I described when I talked about my eyes being dilated. You know, looking down, like with a bifocal on, I felt like my depth was gone, like I wouldn't know where the curb was or where a step was. And I got this really cool pair of, you know, the lenses changed so they could be sunglasses too. I had gotten this pair of glasses, expensive, that I never wore. I found out my brain would not compensate for a bifocal kind of thing. But this way that I've been doing it with my two eyes different, I think it's because your eyes are so close together, you know, just on the other side of the skinny part of your nose, that your brain is just, at least mine, click, it doesn't know the difference. I can just see close up and far away when both of my eyes are looking.
I just got to say, Kim, first of all, thank you for sharing all of this, because obviously it's not recommendation to anybody else, but just to point out that what you do is you put the presets of Brain Injury Radio, the 4 A's, into action at every step. And so what you're describing for you is how awareness, you're aware of the issue, you're aware of your eyes from childhood forward, and the LASIK acceptance. You didn't really accept the condition. You were aware of it, and you accepted it to the extent to get you by, and you always had lenses or took LASIK. And then the action, you took the actions at each step, and the adaptation, you are proof that after your brain injury, after your aneurysm, and we're not 15 years old anymore, is that your brain, not speaking of anybody else's, but your brain had the ability for adaptation immediately to juggle the information. Suddenly, you're getting information from clear lenses going into the retina of your eye, going through all the different processing places in the brain. And you and I, we have damaged brains. And nonetheless, the brain wins out, and the brain in your case instantly adapted. So thank you. And I do think, as we're wrapping up Brain Injury Awareness Month, what you're showing is raising constantly and elevating the awareness of what is potential for the awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation for somebody after a brain injury to achieve the results that have worked for you. It's really quite wonderful.
Well, and not to lose hope, this is, I was going to say, and not to lose hope, because this procedure is 10 years old in this country, but Europe has been doing it for 20. So here, it's relatively new. So even if you're not talking about your eyes, anything that might be a handicap for you, a stumbling block for you after your brain injury, don't lose hope if you haven't found the answer that makes things a little bit better for you, or the best they can be for you, because, you know, technology is going all the time, and studies are being done all the time. And so, you know, one thing Simon is going to talk about, and I'll tell a quick story about, In fact, maybe we'd talk for a minute about, and if this wasn't the order, you can just kick me out of the studio, but we were talking, Simon and I, about hyperbaric oxygen therapy, HBOT, and I just wanted to share real quick that it was funny because when Simon brought it up, I said, well, it's not approved by the FDA. And I remember distinctly, because I've done shows on this, several. I've had individuals who have managed to get, most of the time, what they call a soft unit, and then some private parties that have much bigger bucks were able to get a smaller hard unit, and they would go into business and give hyperbaric oxygen treatments. But those, like so many alternative things we try, were not covered by insurance. But I heard the stories, and people hear things when they need to. There was a guy that used to be a regular here on the show, and he had gotten in a car wreck that put him in a wheelchair 32 years ago. By now, it's probably been 35 years ago, but let's say 32 years ago, and he had been in a wheelchair and had not walked at all. And he heard, in fact, he lives maybe not in your neighborhood, but in Santa Cruz, California. And he heard that show of mine one night. And get this, my guests were in North Carolina. And one of the questions I asked them is to make sure, we did talk about the fact that night that it was not approved by the FDA. So if you went to like a university hospital or talked to a doctor about doing this, there was a list, I remember distinctly, there was a list of 14 things. Because I remember my sardonic humor sometimes. There were two things on there that probably maybe one person a year gets. You know, I mean, it was a couple things nobody's ever heard of in their life that were on that list. And then the other 12 things, burns were a big one. You know, burns have always been a big one that have been on there. But there were 14 things and nothing to do with brain injury was on there. And so you couldn't, even if you went and dropped a pile of gold bars on a doctor's lap at that time, you could not have gotten a doctor in a medical setting with their hyperbaric machine, which they have in the hospital for burn patients, and they had at the VA for burns, you couldn't have, as a private citizen, gotten that treatment. So these private places started popping up, and people who had the money and could afford to, because again, like so many of these treatments, whether it's massage or cranial sacral or somato release or no matter what the therapy is, fund that. It can never be done once or twice or three times and call it good. It's, you know, 50 treatments at whatever a pop. And most the people in this community, you know, people who have brain injury, unless they're a trust fund child, are still able to work at something pretty lucrative, don't have the money to pay for this. But anyway, this man heard the show that night, this regular listener, and it struck him. And he looked up, and I'll be darned, 13 miles away from his house, I asked the people, how do you know that if this isn't, a wand isn't waved by a doctor or someone in the medical profession, how do you know you're not getting a charlatan? You know, how do you know you're not getting somebody that scored a soft machine and they don't know what the hell they're doing? You know, and you wind up getting injured. is there some kind of association or criteria that you look for? And the lady gave me the list of everything that you should look for to find, make sure somebody was reputable before you tried it with them. Well, he did this all the way across the country. The guest is from North Carolina. He's in Santa Cruz, looks it up, finds out there's one of these places that near to his house on, he wasn't driving, on the whatever it was, bus line or streetcar line or whatever it was, where he could go from his home right to it in 12 or 13 miles. And he had the money, got a number of treatments. I can't tell you how many. I think it was 30 to 50 treatments. And the night he came on, and this is the book I want to write someday that I thought I was going to be doing instead of the one that I am going to be finishing, that this story will be in it. It's the miracles that I've heard over my tenure here, is that he walked. I won't tell you that he got rid of his wheelchair, threw it off to the side, and is walking like his injury never happened. He still uses a wheelchair, but is able to walk with a three-wheeled walker for bits of time, and he hadn't walked in 32 years.
Good God. Oh,
and so that's my story about HBOD. And my deal at the time was I was so angry that if you wanted to try it, because, you know, if you don't have somebody that's got one of those private clinics in your state, you know, it would not only cost you a fortune to get the treatments when you've got machines, you can swing a cat and hit the machines at the hospitals that are in your city, your neighborhood, your state. But think of what it would cost if you had to go across the country and put yourself up in a place to stay for that length of time and pay for the treatments. It just takes it off the board for you, off the table for you to even try it. And at the time I was thinking of my dad, for example, who had Parkinson's, and I thought about some of the residuals that I have. I heard it in the context of brain injury and helping the things that go with that, and I thought we should be able to try it, especially something like what my dad had. And the guys, I don't know if they're letting, in fact, I wanted to bring up to you, when I look today and when I do shut up, Simon will be talking a long time, but occasion, because he wrote me back about this, and I said, well, that's not, the FDA doesn't cover that. And he made a comment that made me go back and look up the FDA again. Well, they added something called, what was it, car crashes, or crashes.
Crashes.
Something like that.
Yes.
And I'm like, what the hell? Crashes. All right, so they're going to help maybe, feasibly. That is so loose and speculative exactly what that means with crashes. Do you need to crash and snap your spinal cord? Do you need to crash and they will help your head? And what about all the people that have a brain injury that didn't crash? You know, but the brain is the brain. Yeah, we all got a different story. Yeah, they're all different. But they are all the brain. So what about, for example, the person who isn't in the NFL, who has CTE, or someone like my dad who had a degenerative disease where they have no hope? What is the problem with letting them try something like that? But anyway, crashes in the For What It's Worth column, and whoever decides whether it qualifies or not, whatever you've got, whether your doctor can pitch, but I have a feeling it's up to Medicare or your private insurance, whether they're going to cover it or not. I don't know where the parameter is that explains the breadth of crashes. That just seemed like a weird way to put it. You know, they could have put like TBI, you know, or brain injury, which would have covered a lot of turf, but crashes. Could you be more specific on that? But that's progress. At least that word is on there, so if you happen to be somebody that had a car crash, you might be able to use it. But anyway, so they're changing a little, and I would encourage you all in this Brain Injury Awareness Month. Simon's going to tell a story, and I don't know the answer to it if it worked for him, but I do know from many of the, and there is no panacea for everybody, okay, or we'd all be finding a way to do it and it would be the answer, like the cure to anything else. You know, if there was one thing that worked, we'd all make sure it was happening. But I would encourage you in this Brain Injury Awareness Month to lobby to have the FDA broaden that crashes word to TBI or brain injury, which again covers a whole lot more turf than the word crashes, so that people are able to be afforded the opportunity to try that. I know there's a lot of things out there, they're all out of pocket, but these machines have been paid for already, and so you still might not be able to afford it, even if they let you do it. But you should get the opportunity to be able to try it if you can, is my opinion. So if you happen to be talking to a legislator or want to drop a line or a dime to the FDA to ask for clarity on crashes and ask a few questions, have you considered putting traumatic brain injury? Because for, you know, the VA may work completely different, but blast injuries are the concussive effect that concussions cause in athletes and everybody else who gets them. And now see, those aren't crashes, but they're brain injuries that might benefit from this kind of treatment. So anyway, it's worth a shot. Now that I found out that they've changed it, I'm going to be questioning it a little bit more with the agency and also, you know, with my congressman who used to run the Air Force base here. So he's a military man, and maybe there'd be a little luck moving in that direction. But in any case, that's all I got to say on that, is a lot of these treatments that we all use that don't get paid for, when you look at that list, there's more people that get a TBI every year, new ones, let alone the old ones, that are suffering the residuals for the rest of their life, but new ones every year than any other condition on the list of approved uses for the HBOT machine, those 14 things or whatever they are. There are more brain injuries every year than anything else that's on that list. So it's worth a shot. Anyway, that was a very happy story for him. He was floored, as you can imagine, as happy as I am with my eyesight. He was so happy that he could stand up now and use the walker to do things around his apartment. It was, after 32 years, it was a miracle to him.
Well, I'm eager, Kim, to say a lot of things because, first of all, thank you for sharing about that. It's called, in the literature, anecdotal. evidence, an anecdote being a story of an individual person. And there is a tendency to diminish the broad implications because we're not doctors. And the fact that one person can stand up for 32 years somehow gets less attention and it's easy to discard. The word that sometimes is used in medical research is they'll say that it's an outlier result. And I don't subscribe to that point of view because it's still a result. It's clearly a true result. It's somebody that you know directly, and it's direct evidence of what was possible for that one patient. And I don't agree that therefore one can somehow dismiss it and say, oh, they're an outlier. That's not true across a broad population. It's just specific to that person. Because that's an extraordinary result. I spent quite a lot of time, as listeners know, about 3 months in bed, because in my hospital bed, in a body cage, basically, because my pelvis was crushed and my spine was broken. So that moment of first being able to rise to my feet and your colleague having that experience. So let's talk about HBOT, and again, encouraging people to be aware, acceptance of the knowledge, take action, and then see how far you, in your circumstances, are capable of adaptation. In terms of HBOT, if you want to look online, because Kim and I were having this conversation, and I've got a lot to say, let's start with the fact this shift in extending insurance coverage, even to include the word crash. The process of extending insurance coverage by Centers for Medicare Services, CMS, or Medicaid, or the Veterans Administration is a glacier. And we all know why, because if they open the door just a tiny little bit by adding one condition, it could literally open the door to millions of patients having coverage. And the immediate reaction tends to be, well, that's to do with money and rationing. But not entirely. As I'm going to explain a little bit more, and I'm not a doctor, so this is purely my observations based on what I've read and researched, not direct medical evidence either, but just my observations, is it's not entirely rationing. It's also because of not wanting accidentally to kill patients. And that's an important consideration. You don't want to have people suddenly die unnecessarily. And I'll get into that a little bit more. But adding the word crashes, Kim, is huge for something that normally moves slow as a glacier. Because what is a crash? A crash is a blunt force trauma. And the possible ways in which a blunt force trauma, I mean, a knife, somebody is stabbed with a knife. It's very specific. The knife follows a particular path specific to that knife wound. The doctors try to save the life. The issue is which blood vessels have been severed. Where did the knife go? Is the tip of the knife still inside the victim? It's a very specific range of questions. When FDA have added the word crash and blunt force trauma, it's kind of opening a Pandora's box because a blunt force trauma can affect any part of the body, any part of the brain, in an almost infinite number of directions and ways. And that's just counting where the impact was first felt. Then there are the secondary shocks in terms of the brain. As listeners may know, I've talked about this before. In my accident, which is normal, when there's blunt force trauma to the skull, there is the first impact. And then because the brain is basically floating in a glass ball, your skull, in fluid,
Right.
All the fluid washes in one direction, and then it washes back in the other direction. So the first direction shock is called the coup, C-O-U-P. That's French for blow. So the blow is whack. My 80-mile-an-hour truck hit me in one direction. And then, purely by reason of the way physics works, the liquid holding my brain went in one direction, and then it rebounded on the other side of my skull, coming back in the other direction. And the doctors call that the contra coup, C-O-N-T-R-E-C-O-U-P, the other blow, the in the opposite direction, the contra blow. So opening the word crash is huge. It means that there's now a consideration underway of all the different ways, both directly and indirectly, that a crash may create injuries that may or may not be helped by HBOT. So let me now talk about just one piece of research, because Kim and I have these, frankly, for me, great conversations. Prior to our going on the air, and this is a very recent piece of research, December 2022. I never date our shows, but you can look it up. This is only a few months ago. And this research is by the National Institute for, I've lost a little bit of my place here, my notes. Hold on, I shall find it. National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke Research. So this is spot on what we're talking about. And what they're researching right now is the interrelationship of severe brain injury. So we're not talking about somebody who trips and falls, but we are talking about perhaps football players, severe brain injury, and hyperbaric oxygen therapy, the HBOT. And the fact that it's an active area of research is great in Brain Injury Awareness Month. It means that the awareness is growing. The summary of this research, to save people if they don't want to look it up on the internet, the summary is the purpose of this innovative, adaptive phase two trial design. Phase two means it's a trial being designed prior to trying clinical tests, which is phase three. So it's not phase one, this is phase two, prior to clinical trials. And they say is to determine the optimal combination of hyperbaric oxygen treatment parameters that is most likely to demonstrate improvement in the outcome of severe TBI patients for a subsequent phase three trial. That would be where they'd actually start clinically trialing patients in hospital settings. Their description, it
fantastic.
Says preclinical. I'm sorry, Kim?
I said fantastic. Keep going.
Well, it's very encouraging. I mean, this is reason for hope and hope for
yes.
our reason. So the preclinical, so now, what they've already done, preclinical typically, I don't know, but preclinical means that they started testing with animal models, with small animals causing them severe brain injury and then having them see how they responded to HBO2. But what they said is that they're preclinical and clinical investigations. That means patients in settings, and I can talk about my own experience, but they're saying here that the preclinical and clinical investigations strongly indicate that hyperbaric oxygen is physiologically active in improving the destructive processes in severe TBI. However, this is where I'm saying, well, one has to approach carefully, and be, as Kim, you're great because you were describing the steps necessary to make sure that one's not approaching a charlatan or somebody who's got a free unit and they're trying to find a way to make money out of it. I mean, there are people who can get one of these units put in their homes. It says here, this is now, you know, serious research. Prior to a definitive efficacy study, important information is required regarding optimizing the treatment paradigm in terms of pressure. And one of the questions is whether what they call NBH, and this is what they're testing at the moment, is there a difference between what's called normobaric hyperoxia, which is having people breathing oxygen in a room. Why not sit in a room breathing in from an oxygen flask? Whether the pressure, the application going into the tube or into a large room, whether that enhances the effectiveness, the atmospheric pressure being increased. So that's what they're trying to do at the moment. And the preclinical investigators, that's the animal stuff typically, they used pressures varying from 1.5 to 3 ATA. You and I right now, listening, are sitting in a room that's one atmosphere, that's regular atmosphere at sea level. I mean, if you're listening to this 8,000 miles up or 7,000 feet up in the Colorado Mountains, you're at a bit less atmosphere because you're not at sea level. So they're testing from 1.5 to 3 of sea level atmosphere. And that's for the model, the animal models. For patients, they've tried pressures varying from 1.5 to 2.5, more conservative. Why are they being more conservative with patients as opposed to animals? And this is where we get into risk factors and why, if you're listening to this, you must not deal with charlatans. You must go to a real doctor, real experts, get real medical advice. The reason they're being more conservative with severe TBI patients is because, and I'm quoting now from the study, in severe TBI patients, they frequently have been compromised. Sorry, I'll start again. The lungs in severe TBI patients have frequently been compromised by direct lung injury and or acquired ventilator pneumonia, and they are susceptible to oxygen toxicity. That's why I had to be very careful and be in good hands, because in my blunt force trauma, ribs 1 through 9 had compound fractures, my chest wall was unstable, I was on a ventilator for a month on full life support. Putting somebody in my circumstance, and I was bleeding through my ears and through my mouth, all of that, and a massive internal hemorrhaging that was going on. In my circumstance, putting me into a ventilator at Cedars-Sinai intensive care quite possibly would have exploded my lungs. I might not have survived being put under that kind of pressure. So that's one big risk factors about being exposed to the pressure or the toxicity. Therefore, the study continues. Working within these constraints, in other words, severe TBI, it is essential to determine the most effective HBOT parameters without producing toxicity and clinical complications. That's a nice way of putting your lungs exploding. This proposed clinical trial is designed to answer these questions and to provide important data to plan a definitive efficacy trial. In other words, efficacy stage 3 in patients. Now, I could say there's other good reasons for hope. Kim pointed me to some remarkable research. Oh, before I go on to the other important research, I do want to highlight another risk factor, because I'm now going to start talking about some actual available studies that are being done overseas. As Kim said, sometimes things happen a lot sooner overseas and are put into effect before they come into the United States. It's very difficult to go through the steps of approval in the United States. The other risk factor is to do with activating stem cells to encourage healing of tissue. And the risk factor is if you do too much, stimulate the stem cells to start dividing and replicating, stem cells, if you recall, can turn into any cell in the body. Those are the pluripotent stem cells. That's the embryonic stem cell tissue that you may recall. And that's, they are enormously powerful. But the issue with the brain is not to trigger too much stem cell activity, because too much stem cell replication and cells dividing, if it's not self-regulating, which is what happens when we're born and we're young and we're having tremendous activity with our baby's infant stem cells, too much cell replication is another word for cancer. So what we're trying to do, what the doctors are trying very carefully to study, is how to encourage stem cells in the brain to cause repair, but not overstep and lead to brain cancer. In other words, creating a much, much greater and potentially fatal complication. So the research that Kim pointed me to is a Tel Aviv facility, and a Dr. Efrat, and you can look him up, and it's very interesting, his description of what they're doing with HBOT specific to brain injury. If I can do something as a non-doctor, which is really unforgivable, and that's to distill down what Dr. Efrat and his team are doing, it seems, and that these are his protocols, the way he describes his protocol, and he's not giving up online the specifics, but the shape of the protocol is he starts with a patient with TBI, severe TBI. He then evaluates them very carefully with very advanced computer-assisted diagnostic imaging, the purpose of which is to establish where is the brain damaged specifically. Because I'm speaking as a person where about a third, a bit more than a third of the right side of my brain is encephalomalacia, which is a nice word for dead scar tissue. No amount of HBOT is going to resuscitate or change that dead scar tissue. It's gone. It's, as I said, it's gone and it ain't coming back. The issue, what Dr. Efrat and his team, I'm not promoting his approach, there are other approaches, is you need to know whether it's going to help the patient, because you don't have the risk of cancer if the areas of damage are all scar tissue. But I get the impression that using this expensive advanced scans imaging, that from that he derives, and he shows pictures on the internet, and you can see that there's an area of dead tissue and there's a margin, which is what you'd sort of expect, that there's damage to the brain. And as you get to the edge of that area of damage, you start coming to the edge of the damage where normal healthy brain tissue still exists. And it looks, as a non-doctor, that what he's showing in his images of before and after is a margin where there's brain activity where before there wasn't. So it's restoring on the edges. I believe that I'm an anecdote demonstrating that restoring some activity across the edges of a massive brain injury, I mean, I'm beyond massive TBI, demonstrates how much functionality can be recovered, because we're edging into the issue of if you can bring back some brain tissue along the margin of what is permanently lost, how far can neuroplasticity, how far can your brain learn how to take those remaining signals and work around the lost area of brain tissue? So now, his protocol is establish what can, in theory, be done. The other thing which he is very clear on. If you were to watch right to the end, he becomes the final question in the Q&A. A doctor calls in about their hyperbaric chamber, which works at 1.3 atmospheres. And Dr. Afrat almost loses his temper at that point, because what he's trying to do, he spent the entire presentation saying his approach is special, he does it this way, he looks at the brain, and then I think it's something like a minimum, as Kim described quite accurately, his protocol is a minimum of, let's say, 30 sessions. I'm going to try and find what he says, actually, in my notes.
Something like that.
If I can see it. I think there's something like 30 or... I found my note. He's working with 2 ATA, twice the atmospheric pressure at sea level, which increases the blood oxygenation, the amount of oxygen in the blood from 100 mercuries to 1500. So he's taking the amount of blood oxygenation that's measured up by a factor of 15, from 100 mercuries to 1500, for a minimum of 40 sessions, 5 days a week, each session lasting 2 hours. With his kind of magic sauce on top of that, on top of the measurements and the analysis beforehand, it's what's called induced hypoxia. And the thing that leads me then back to my experience of HBOT is that's actually sort of what I did to myself without realizing it many years ago. Mm-hmm. What this Dr. Afrat wondered is that what causes the body to heal is the body discovers that there has been damage. Typically, that's damage to blood that's in your circulatory system, and it's damage that occurs in the lymphatics. We don't have time to go into the lymphatics, but they're critical as well. And there are cells in the blood, fibroblasts. And what happens if you've got a cut or a knife wound? The fibroblasts get disturbed that are in the blood floating around, and they start to congregate at the area of the damage and start forming clots. And I won't go into COVID tonight, but that's one of the huge issues I'm sure listeners have heard about, which is that COVID in many patients triggers a clotting factor at a tiny level. They're called microclots, and they cause
strokes, yeah.
But that's one kind of way in which the body responds to damage. Another aspect which Dr. Afrat focuses on is loss of oxygen, and that's called hypoxia. And you cannot mm-hmm. safely subject a patient to loss of oxygen because they'll suffocate. I mean, you can put a polythene bag over your head, and the body will go into overdrive and the brain will go frantic with healing response because the brain is being denied oxygen. The problem is that very quickly you're denying oxygen to the extent that tissue in your brain is going to start dying and you're going to die of suffocation. So you can't induce hypoxia safely for a patient. But the thing that kind of blew me away, quite honestly, and was fascinating, was Dr. Afrat and his team wondered, what is the body measuring? Because the body doesn't have sophisticated technology. It's not measuring 100 mercuries to 1500. The body isn't saying, gee, you've got 10% less oxygen now. But actually, that's exactly what the body is doing. And what he tested, and I think he's demonstrated with his lab's test results, is that the body is not measuring the absolute level of oxygen in your bloodstream. And I have to add one thing. In his presentation, he only talks about oxygen. That is a very incomplete assessment of what the blood is bringing to you every minute, every second, to all the cells in your body. It's bringing oxygen, yes, but it's bringing glucose, is bringing a host of nutrients that the body requires. But let's, okay, I stayed that point. Let's come back now to the main thing that he is describing. He wondered, is the body measuring the absolute level of oxygen, or is it measuring what's called the delta? And delta is the Greek symbol of a D, or delta, for difference, for differential. It's used in mathematical equations. In other words, if you just slightly lower the amount of oxygen in the blood, will the body respond as if there's an emergency? And what he is doing in his protocol is he is not using the torpedo tube with which many listeners are familiar, which is what I went. I had 50 or so, 60 perhaps, hyperbaric cylinder treatments. He's putting patients in a room, a suite. So they're sitting on a chair in with a group of other patients sitting there.
Right.
And what he has them do is deceptively simple. He takes them up to 1,500 mercuries in their blood. And then he tells the patient for a certain amount of time in that room, take off your mask. And what the body does then is it notices the delta, the differential. It notices that you are dropping down from 1,500 to 1,400. It doesn't care about the fact that normally there's 100. So the body doesn't say, oh, no problem. Normally I've got 100, but I've got 1,400. I've got lots of oxygen. No. What the body notices apparently is that you had 1,500 and now you've only got 1,400. And that triggers, according to Dr. Afrat and his results, the healing response and the timing, the amount of time he does it for as the amount of oxygen is falling. He doesn't go into the details, but that's the concept. And that triggers the stem cells in the brain. It activates them, so that they then start dividing and replicating. They, first of all, they make more stem cells. That's what they do. They create more stem cells. They initiate the healing response. And what he is describing, the wide induction of brain stem cells to replicate that could yield many questions, many benefits, subject to stimulating cell replication and causing brain cancer. His presentation makes no reference to that risk or whether he's done any long-term studies. But coming back to the last point I want to make about this is that the most critical thing is this is not something where you can do it yourself. This is something to explore. This is something to see whether it ever comes in here. This is something to talk to your representatives and the VA administration, because the end of Dr. Afrat's presentation, to simplify, is showing a lot of patients with significant benefits that would not previously have been expected. And to summarize my access to hyperbaric oxygen, which was paid for by insurance, was that I had some plastic surgery. I had so many scars that a plastic surgeon did a revision to help me, basically, to help reduce the amount of scar tissue. I've been through the wars and back, but the main thing that matters is that I'm back. You know, I survived. And oddly enough, and this was years ago, this was probably 25 years ago, before HBOT was widely accepted, but as Kim has described, has always been recommended for burn patients who have extensive skin damage, because it triggers basically the stem cells in the skin, those cells to replicate, it stimulates that. It's very, very helpful for burn victims. And also, plastic surgeons deal with skin. And so my plastic surgeon said, why don't you go and have some oxygen therapy? I'd never thought about it. I said, do you think that will help? Oh, yes, he said. It will help the surgery I've done on your skin. It'll help the recovery to remove some of the scar tissue. And then he brightly added, and it helps all the healing. It helps all the cells heal. So, so it could help your brain too. And I'm saying this because that's what I mean about that the process of insurance approval moves like a glacier. Because 25 years ago, a plastic surgeon, it's in my book, I put it into Rise and Shine for that reason. I wanted to give people clues about the hidden path to full recovery, or at least to recovery. And he knew that years ago. And I want to add something which is kind of interesting. At the point that I went to have oxygen therapy, hyperbaric therapy, I had a big problem, which was periodically my eyes would turn like Dracula. I used to call it, it's in my book, I said a Dracula eye, I called it. And it was very, very ugly to see. And I get these things where my eye would be just full of bloodshot and expanded blood vessels, conjunctivitis, the doctors would call it. And they'd give me eye drops, antibiotic eye drops, stronger and stronger antibiotic eye drops, and it would go away and then it would come back. And I felt even then, this was not long after my huge hit and run, I felt that I was being given a nostrum, that's the term for it, I guess, a quack medicine, that they're just giving me stuff to make a symptom go away. But I didn't know what the cause was. I still don't know what the cause was. I can say one thing with certainty, and I put it into my book again, so it's not like I'm inventing it. The book came out over 10 years ago. The day after my first hyperbaric oxygen therapy, I went into my bathroom to shave. I looked into the mirror, and my Dracula eye was the worst I had ever seen. My eyes, I think there's one eye in particular, was every shade of purple and red and blue. It was horrific. And I wasn't worried. I could not have been happier. Because what the plastic surgeon had explained is that what hyperbaric oxygen does is it drives oxygen into all the places in the body everywhere, even places that it cannot reach because circulation has been constricted. That's the comment that Dr. Efrat makes in his presentation on YouTube, if you look it up. That's, I think, why he's focusing on the oxygen, not the glucose and everything else. His point is that when you've had a brain injury and you've got constriction, or you've had a stroke, and again, the stroke has clotted and constricted the flow of blood in the brain, that disables oxygen from reaching certain areas where the blood would normally flow. You shove oxygen in, whether it's at one or two atmospheres, for a prolonged period, the oxygen permeates every cell without even going through the bloodstream to get there. It's just being absorbed by the tissue. The tissue is taking it in without it coming through the blood supply, the hemoglobin in your blood. So the consequences for infection, and this is really odd, is that oxygen is really toxic to microorganisms. They don't like oxygen at all. We like oxygen, but they are used to living, I guess, without oxygen. So it kills microorganisms. And when I walked into the bathroom the day after that first hyperbaric therapy, and my eye had erupted, my belief at that time was that that would be the last time that I had Dracula eye. Now, the flip side of that was when I went to see my doctor, and I named him in the book. I won't bother to name him now because maybe his view would change. Maybe he wouldn't want to be named now. But my vision developmental optometrist, I said to him, is it possible that this hyperbaric oxygen somehow has killed organisms that were somehow alive in my skull that my blood could not reach to kill? And he answered, I don't think so, he said, because the eye socket is on its own circulation. It's isolated. Now, my belief is that from my brain surgery, there were fragments of, tiny fragments of titanium left in my skull. And as is often the case, because all of my hardware became infected because it was, what do they call it, triage. I mean, I was dying when I was admitted. They opened me up as a John Doe. They didn't know what they were going to find. And so a lot of the surgery was done in ways that led to there being infection on the hardware, which was found later on. But once there's infection on hardware in the body, the circulatory system cannot reach it to get rid of it. So my belief is that the hyperbaric oxygen, if you have a lurking infection, it can kill it. That's another reason why it's so effective after crashes, because, or somebody who's been stabbed with a knife, all of these traumas caused by third parties, basically, not internally originating, they typically carry with them a lot of infection. And hyperbaric oxygen permeates the body and is very good at killing it. And that's what happened, I believe, to me. So, Kim, possibly in way more detail than your audience, our audience would like to hear, that's the encouraging news about research that's ongoing right now into finding protocols to treat severe TBI patients without endangering their lives so that it can be administered one day post crashes in a hospital, knowing what pressure for how long and what is safe after assessment of the status of their lungs, whether they have pneumonia, whether they have enough intact ribs to undergo the pressure. But in Brain Injury Awareness Month, as we're wrapping it, we are really in very exciting times.
We are, and there's two things that I want to mention. Sorry, I thought I had muted myself. I did for a minute. I've got a dog that started crying, and they think that the dog door is blocked, but I went and unblocked it, so pardon me for a minute. Hi, Libby. Hi, Eddie. Come on in.
Aw, welcome back, Libby and Eddie. Welcome back.
I usually block the dog door so they don't go out and bark, but Libby was crying by the door, so I knew she needed to go. Anyway, we are in the last few minutes, but thank you for all of that information. There was just two things I wanted to mention before we close tonight, and that is really exciting, the research and the stuff about HBOT hyperbarics. And that is, you hear from the Brain Injury Association of America, and every state either has an association or an alliance. Long story, I won't get into. There's not both in any state. Well, I guess I can tell you. There just was the mothership, Brain Injury Association of America, and each state had a branch. Well, with any association, you have to pay dues. And in a lot of states like ours, there were two people, well, a person and a half. running the brain injury office. That's what the budget facilitated. And so by the time they paid their association dues, and this happened in states all over the country, they didn't really have any money to even have that ruddy once a year walk with the scratchy t-shirt to help raise awareness during the month. And so many of them broke off and called themselves a Brain Injury Alliance. That got them out of paying dues. It also got them out of association with Brain Injury Association of America because they were no longer paying dues, which put them in a more isolated place in the beginning when states started doing this. But it's been done for enough years now that regions get together, whether it's on Zoom or actual meetings pre-COVID, where they have discussions as regional alliances, but they're all there. One of the things Craig, our founder, is doing, I'm really proud of, and hopefully this will go all over the country, but he's one step away, and I'm not a lawyer or a doctor. And thank you always for giving those disclaimers, Simon. I don't always remember. I just know I'm a brain injury survivor. I just talk about what I know and read, but I appreciate the fact that you do that. Anyway, as you're trying to get legislation through the system, whatever the paces are that you have to go through, you know, each level before something goes to the next deal before it's signed into law by the governor, Craig and his group have been People First was the original name of their organization. And it's funny that Brain Injury Association of America and the song I'm going to play out tonight, interesting, is I am more than my brain injury. That's their theme this year on the website, BIAUSA.org. I have interviewed almost all the alliance and association presidents over the last 12 years, from TBI to aneurysm to stroke to any other group you want to find that's dealing with the brain. One question I started asking is, how many survivors do you have on your board? And the answer that I got 100% of the time for the longest time was none. So whether it comes to associations or, let's say, group homes, Craig works at the community college with developmentally disabled college students, and so he's into a little of all things of the brain, let's say, plus he's got his own brain injury from his terrible crash, and then post-COVID, to be honest. long COVID exacerbated and gave him more symptoms. But anyway, he's got some legislation. They have a saying, People First does, nothing about us without us is the name of this legislation. And one of the big things that it deals with, and it's one step away from being able to go to the governor for a signature, is that any group, whether it's an association, an alliance, a private company that owns a bunch of group homes, or a state hospital or something like that, that there's nothing about us without us, meaning that we will be on the boards and have a constructive place in the rules about our care. And I think that's phenomenal. There's people out, you know, and the reason we were talking about it is because a lot of what I'm writing about, and then I'm going to shut that up and go to the next thing, has to do with both. There was a period of time long ago, where my book starts, were people who were insane, were mixed with people who were drunk, who were mixed with people who had maybe a developmental disability. They were all clumped together as being the undesirables before they were split up into groups and knew the difference. Society just thought that anybody that was different was socially unacceptable, and they were sent eventually to asylums altogether with completely different issues. And then group homes came along, and we recently had a scandal, one of the reasons I'm writing this book, over in Iowa, and I believe nothing happens in just one place. And now with the YouTube videos I've watched and the reading I've done, I understand that between the middle 1800s and 2023, there's a lot of the same stuff going on. So the fact that someone is actually working to do something about it to help put us in an empowered situation toward our own destiny, treatment, possibilities is super awesome. So watch Washington State, Spokane, for Nothing About Us, Without Us to be passing hopefully before too long. And I hope when you see it and hear more about it, we'll talk about it on another night, or I'll bring Craig on the show or have him do it on his own, giving us all a lot of details and how he went about it. I hope that we'll find all of the states doing it. It's very important. The top two chairs of the associations, any association, I used to be a professional, I paid association dues. What I can tell you is the top two people in the association get paid a six-figure salary. And it's great during Awareness Month to get on and read the statistics, you know, let the general public who doesn't know a lot know more about our conditions. But if I'm a person who just had a brain injury and I call crying and desperate because my doctor doesn't have the answer, they're throwing bills at it, whatever, what can I do? What can I do? A lot of them don't have a lot to offer unless they happen to have maybe a support group in your state. They can tell you about that. But otherwise, they don't have a lot that they can do for us. So Nothing About Us, Without Us. The last thing I want to say is in the last couple of years since I've been doing these awareness months, we've had some things added, and we got 2 minutes, so I'm going to make it quick for you, but concussion was not considered a TBI and now is categorized as a TBI. That was added to the list of what constitutes a TBI a couple of years ago. So when you go to read statistics, you're going to find a whole new section. And I recommend you go to BIAUSA.org to check out these statistics and some information I'm going to give you to look up. But it talks about concussion, and we have talked about it the last couple of years and on shows, not just Awareness Month, that has been added under the banner of a TBI. This year, I believe, I don't know if it was last year, but this year for sure, COVID-19 is added. There's a whole section. If you go to that website I was talking about, there's a whole section on COVID-19, state-by-state information, a very interesting article, How Does COVID Affect the Brain, by John Hopkins Medicine. The spinal cord and brain injury, a lot of reading to be done there, encouraging you to find out everything you can, and that a lot of us might be at higher risk. So they do recommend the vaccines, and it goes on to many other things. Here are some webinars, learning more about the vaccine, reliable sources, Administration for Community Living, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, National Institute of Health, Combat COVID by the Department of Health and Human Services. There's links to all these things there. Other resources. And we're about to go into overtime. But anyway, you'll see a whole discussion on the neurological concerns that have to do with the virus. And it's funny, it reads, what are ways that coronavirus can affect the brain? Funny that for us particularly, confusion, loss of consciousness, seizures, stroke, loss of smell and taste, headaches, trouble focusing, changes in behavior. Patients are also having peripheral nerve issues, and it goes on to neurological symptoms that they're seeing come out of COVID and then going on to long COVID, which is a whole different subject. But that's been added to the website. And so they are feeling that COVID can definitely have an effect on the brain. And so I encourage you to just check it out, look at it, and be aware. There's a lot of people out there that, because the president said so, think that it's no longer relevant, that the virus is no longer relevant, that we can throw away all of our precautions, we can go back to living life the way we did before, no worries, no concerns, that's all over, not a public emergency anymore. That's not true. They want to say it's endemic, not pandemic now. I'm just going to say, in my opinion, part of that has to do with politics. It doesn't matter what side of the fence you're on. There's no solution yet. So it's a hot potato, and it's nothing anybody wants to talk about who's in any of the political races that have been going on. You notice that's when they quit talking about it on TV. But the thing that should tip you off that it's still an issue is you can't watch an hour television show without seeing the Paxlovid commercial 15 times. And in fact, I talked to my therapist about it a month ago and said, you know, no pun intended, I just speak the way I speak. So anybody into woke, just know that this was a saying a long time before we had issues. The Chinese water torture. For me, seeing those commercials every 2 seconds during every TV show. If I watch a movie, that means that I've seen that commercial 10 times and I have anxiety about it. You know, there's a lot of us like me and you who've lived pretty sheltered lives, and some would think that was foolish of us. I've had comments, and we won't, you know, go on and on with that. I don't want to do that, but I just want to say, you know, one thing that comes out of it not being a national emergency anymore come May 11th or whenever our president's going to do this is that the government will no longer pay for testing. They'll no longer pay for vaccines. They'll no longer pay for therapeutics. You will. So they're tossing the ball back on your lap to be individually and personally responsible. So make no mistake.
If I may add one thing, Kim, nothing is about the COVID, I'd just like to say, for people who want to understand what is occurring, the World Health Organization maintains a website of global statistics, and the Kaiser Family Foundation maintains a website with very helpful statistics, and you can see on the global dashboard how many people are getting it, how many people have died from it, So it's real, it's present, and I'll give the microphone back to you, Kim. But those are two resources in order to make sure you understand what's really going on out there, objectively compiled data.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. And folks, do look up, like I said, just if you got a brain injury, there's a lot of places you can look, but you can start on the Brain Injury Association of America and everything that Simon just said. And just don't be quick to abandon the protocols to keep yourself safe, because now they're putting it in your lap. Don't believe what the politicians are telling you. Listen to the science, which is what a lot of people were saying from the beginning. But what we have to do now is realize that it's not gone, and we have to still be cautious. And so there we go, with concussion and COVID being added under the banner of TBI, that's us winding up TBI Awareness Month. So, Simon, thank you so much for being here tonight and the great discussion. As we always say, you know, every month, every day, every 24 hours is Brain Injury Awareness Month for us survivors, but we have these ribbon months where we're helping make others aware, or maybe newcomers in our community aware, caregivers aware, people that choose to tune in because they see a ribbon somewhere and realize it's Awareness Month, so they see, you know, this podcast come up and watch and listen and learn a little bit about it. There's very few people, when you think about it, there's probably very few people out there that don't know someone who's been affected by a brain injury, whether that's a stroke. You know, when you were talking about hypoxic brain injury, there's a guy who's got a really good support group, Rod, and he's a friend. I've had him on the show. You know, he walked out of his kitchen into his garage to get in the car to go somewhere one day. He had a heart attack and was unconscious on his floor in the garage for a while. His heart stopped. They rescued him, but he had a severe anoxic brain injury because his brain didn't get oxygen during the time that he was out, passed out. And so there's all kinds of brain injuries, but again, their theme this year is more than my brain injury. And interestingly, and also because it's her birthday today, I believe, if not it was yesterday, but Christabel Braden is a brain injury survivor. She's here in my playlist, and I think it's funny because I got this song from her about a decade ago, so I wonder, coincidentally, if she happens to know the people at BIA or if it was just a coincidence. But the name of her song is More to Me, and she's a brain injury survivor. Again, it's Christabel Braden, and you can find a lot of her work on YouTube. On Facebook, you can find Christabel Braden, and I believe .com will take you to her website. But this is a great song. So good night. God bless everybody. I'll see you next week. Simon, thank you very much for, again, being such an integral part of the show. And I will see you next month. And
look forward, Kim. Thank you.
You bet. And happy birthday, Christabel.
In a memory, where do I belong? It's been so long, and every time I try to make sense of anything, find that I'm stressed about everything. This isn't who I used to be.